I'm going to begin this morning by confessing my sins. I don't usually confess my sins in public, but this morning I'm going to. When I was young, I hope it was very young, but I may have been about 7 or 8, when my parents went out, I used to go through their drawers. Now, has anybody else ever done that? Your children almost certainly do, just to warn you. And in my father's chest of drawers were some little boxes, rather like this one. It's quite nice. It's made of velvet on the outside, and it's got some silk on the inside. And he used to use these little boxes for keeping cufflinks and shirt studs and things like that. Strange thing was that many of the boxes that he kept were empty, rather like this one. It's got nothing in it. And I wondered why he kept them, and I don't know why he did keep them. It seems to me that a lot of people have done with Christianity what my father did with those boxes. They have kept the shell, the outer shell, which is often quite nice, nice church services, beautiful music, church architecture, velvet and silk, nicely made. But they have lost the key thing for which it was made. That is Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth. And the first thing that we rediscover about Christianity as we open up Paul's letter to the Romans is that it's about him. It is about a person, a real person, who lived in history. Real, like you are real and I am real. And you'll see that if you turn to the passage. It's printed on a sheet. And I think it will be very helpful to you and also to me if you have it close at hand. Verse 2. Where he talks about the gospel, which is the good news of Christianity, which God promised beforehand through the prophets. In other words, it's not newfangled. It didn't come out of nowhere. It's rooted in the Old Testament, first of all. And it's about his son, who as to his human nature was a descendant of David, and who through the Spirit is declared to be the Son of God, Jesus. All of us have ancestors. Mine were Viking raiders from Sweden who came over to the Orkneys and caused a lot of trouble. His ancestors were rather better behaved than mine. His chief ancestor was David, who was a very important king in Old Testament times, member of the Jewish people and king of the Jews. So Jesus belonged to a specific race. He lived at a particular time. So he was rooted in history. Christianity, you see, is not rooted in philosophy. It's rooted in history. Our title, what's it all about? It's about him. Jesus of Nazareth, a descendant of David and said to be the Son of God. Two things. First of all, Christianity is historically true. You'll find these two things on the back of the sheet. This is the outline. That is the claim that Christianity makes, that it's historically true. And immediately we have a contrast with all the other religions of the world. Most of them came from about the 6th century BC, when there was a great tidal wave of revolt against the priestcraft that was operating in the known world at that time. So you have Zoroaster in Persia, Maccabees and Buddha in India, Confucius in China, Socrates back in Athens, all at about the same time, revolted against this priestcraft, and they came up with philosophies. And these philosophies became religions. And much later, Muhammad did the same in Saudi Arabia. And there are these and many others. And people are asked to look at them, assess them, weigh them up, and try and work out which of them they prefer. And then along comes the Apostle Paul and says, no. Christianity is not like that. Completely different. He says, I'm not asking you to choose from a smorgasbord of religious philosophies. I want you to come along and examine evidence. Look at the evidence. Look at this person who lived. And what you will find if you do that is that Jesus lived a wonderful life and at one and the same time made the most incredible claims about himself. Now, people who live wonderful lives usually are admired, but they are not worshipped, are they? I mean, wonderful people don't want to be worshipped. And people who make incredible claims about themselves are usually dismissed as nutters and not believed. But Jesus falls into both camps. He lived a wonderful life. He made incredible claims about himself. And also, he was believed. And that belief turned over the Roman Empire of its day. Here is a man who proclaims himself to be God in all humility, and he convinced those around him that it was true. And what you've got to realize is that Jesus was Jewish, and those with whom he lived and worked and ate and slept for 3 years, they were Jewish like he was. And the Jews had a very particular view of the transcendence of God that was unmatched in any place in the world. For the Jews, God was transcendent. He was high above. He created the world. He was without beginning and ending. He was so holy that you weren't even allowed to take his name upon your lips. The last people in the world who would believe that a human being could be God was a group of first century Jews. And yet, they did. And if you take a gospel, and I do ask you to do this, perhaps in the coming week, take a gospel and read it carefully and seriously, and you will too. Because you will not be able to explain this incredible person in any other way. If you can, come and tell me. Tim Keller said this: "No one has ever discovered the word Jesus ought to have said or the deed he ought to have done. He never falls short. In fact, he is always surprising you because he is better than you can imagine. Why? Because they are the surprises of perfection." What's it all about? It is about him. A person who combined virtues not seen together in anybody else. Tenderness without weakness. Strength without harshness. Humility without the slightest lack of confidence. Holiness and unbending conviction without the slightest lack of approachability. Power without insensitivity. Judgment on the self-satisfied, and yet the most winsome kindness to the broken and to the marginal. Never inconsistent, never a false step, never a jarring note. P.T. Forsyth said this: "If God be not thus, he is less than the God we crave and less than the God the world needs. This is the holy love that deserves to be almighty." And even describing it, can you not begin to see what they saw? That group of first century Jews who felt they were looking through the substance of human flesh at the very being of God. And that is the claim that Christianity makes, that God came in history. You see, the invitation of the New Testament is not just believe, 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 close your eyes and just hope it's true. It's investigate, investigate, investigate. Look at the evidence, examine it. And you will find that it's good, and it needs to be, because much is at stake. Have a look at verse 4 again, where Jesus is referred to as Christ, which means anointed king, our Lord. And Paul says that through him, they, the apostles, were to call people from amongst all the Gentiles to the obedience that comes from faith. You see, if this is true, historically true, then Jesus is the Lord, but he's more than that. He's your Lord, my Lord, our Lord, and we need to obey him as such. There is an obedience that flows from faith and is required by it. So you see, this is important, but it's also personally very challenging. And it all hangs on the identity of this person. If you're going to obey somebody, if you're going to commit your life to them, you need to know who they are. We went on holiday to the Channel Islands in August. We had a lovely time and very nice weather. And the family came over to stay, Lucy and Anthony and Seb and Isaac. And Seb features in this illustration I'm going to give you. So we're going to have a photograph of him, I think. That's Seb on holiday, Seb up a tree. And the next one is Seb in the sea. He's up a tree with his hat, and he's in the sea with his boat, which we bought him. He's got all his clothes on, I think. Hasn't bothered to take them off. He was absolutely dripping wet. And we play a game, or I play a game with Seb. And we go into the sea, and I'm up to about here, and he's right up to here, and a big wave comes in, and he gets absolutely soaked. And then we run out of the sea, and we have a race on the beach to a designated point or person, which is the finishing line. And we come out of the sea, and I said, I'll race you to Nana, who's sitting over there, actually known as Nanu. Not quite sure why, but she's Nanu. So we're racing across the beach. His little legs are scuttling as fast as they can go, and Seb's in the lead, and then Opal's in the lead, and then Seb's in the lead. Seb also always has to be in the lead at the end. That's the unspoken rule of the game, and so it is with most grandparents. Anyway, we're racing up the beach, and he decides he's going to cut across. He cuts me up. So keen is he that I should not overtake. And he is now on a different trajectory, and he is now on track, not for Nana, but for another woman on the beach who is walking along. She is a lady, not dressed for building sandcastles. In fact, she has got her white, not her daughter's jeans on. Very fashionable, but white, impractical in my opinion. Don't go for white jeans. She's got a turquoise chemise and various other fashionable accessories. And she's now right in his line of path, but not vision. And Seb keeps going, and he keeps going, and he keeps going. And to my horror, he hurls himself into her arms, thinking that she is Nanu, which she is not. And I think this is going to end in tears, because this dedicated follower of fashion is now dripping wet and covered in sand and seaweed. And Seb realizes, to his horror, the mistake that he has made. And I thought, this is going to end in tears. This is not going to end well. But actually, he was very lucky, because she was a lovely lady. She said, it's made my day. What a beautiful little boy you are. So nice to have a hug, even a soggy one. So it ended well for him. But it won't end well for you, if you don't mind me saying so. If you're going in the wrong direction, if you're going to embrace the wrong person, all of us will embrace somebody or something to give life meaning and to give ourselves meaning. So you must get the identity right of this person, that which you live for, that which drives you. Make sure it's him. Look at the evidence. Get right about his identity and trust and obey and put your arms around him. Because it's true, and because he has power to change and redirect life. Now we come on to the second heading on the sheet. That is vitally relevant. Not only is it historically true, this is vitally relevant. I've picked up quite a lot of useless information in the Channel Islands over the last few weeks on holiday. For example, did you know that seagulls drink fresh water and seawater? Did you know that? You'd think they'd prefer one, wouldn't you? But they don't. They drink both. Second piece of useless information. Did you know that the size of Jersey increases by 1/5, that is 20%, when the tide goes out? You wouldn't think it was that much, would you? It's true. The really frightening thing is that those are probably the only two things you'll remember from this talk. But they're hardly going to change your life, are they? Paul's conviction is that Christianity is historically true and vitally relevant because it will change your life, because it addresses the big issues that we face. I used to go to an osteopath in Tewkesbury called Mike Lloyd-Jones. It's very good, actually. I recommend him to you if you've got back problems. He used to lie me down on this couch on my front, and I have a bad back, and he used to work his way up my back, and he got to a particular point, and I went, ow, that's it. That is the point that hurts. That hurts for me. That's where the problem is. Now, I am willing to bet that as I touch on these four points, which seems to me to be big issues in life today, you will feel the point as I touch upon it, on one of these points. You'll say, that hurts. That is an issue for me. These are the key issues of life today. Steve, can we just run through where we've got to? Historically true, vitally relevant. Second heading. And then these are the issues. The first one is the question of death. Woody Allen said that he wasn't afraid of dying, he just didn't want to be there when it happened. Actually, all of us are afraid of dying, and we'll all be there when it happens. It's the one thing we've got in common, every single one of us. All of us, one day will die. And it's rather sad the way that some people won't face up to it. Every year in this country, thousands of people die intestate, just assuming never going to happen to them. There was a youngster who was visiting his Christian grandparents, and they were asking him about his plans. And he said, oh, I'm going to get 25 GCSEs. And they said, what then? He said, oh, I'll get 5 grade A-levels. And they said, what then? He said, I'll go to a really good university, Oxford, or if I fail that, Cambridge. What then? He said, I'll get a top job in the city. What then? He said, I'll become a member of parliament, safe Tory seat. And they said to him, what then? I'll get a life peerage. What then? He said, I'll retire and have a big house in the country. What then? He said, well, one day I'll die. What then? Never thought about it. Hadn't even crossed the landscape of his mind. And it certainly wasn't factored into his plans. And it's often only the shock of a death in the family that brings us face to face with this issue as we sit there looking at a coffin at the front of a beautiful church. Second issue, Steve, please, is the meaning of life. What is the point? What is the point of life? The endless slog, the emptiness, and the seeming futility. In the small hours, wrote Cyril Connolly, when the acrid stench of existence rises like sewer gas from everything created, the emptiness of life seems more terrible than its misery. And that's how many people feel, bored out of their brains by the sheer monotony of it. And they try many things, but in the end, the small hours return, and with them the emptiness. Then next one, Steve, is the issue of guilt. You will have heard how Conan Doyle apparently once sent a telegram to 10 of his friends. They were at the top of their particular trees, politics, the arts, academia, industry, the army. And the telegram was identical. It said, flee for your life, all is discovered. And apparently within 24 hours, all 10 had left the country. That's how I feel. When I got to see a police car in my rearview mirror, I panic. I start to worry. All I have discovered in many years of pastoral ministry is that people who outwardly seem so confident and so successful and so self-assured, inwardly are churned up and they're hurting. And there is something from their past that is still haunting them, a guilt, and they're longing for it to be removed. Margarita Lasky was in the Times this week. I don't know whether you saw her. She's a very, very distinguished humanist. And she said this, what I envy most about you Christians is your forgiveness. There's no one to forgive me. Then finally, there is the matter of esteem. All of us need to feel valuable, don't we? To feel that we are significant. But many of us don't, and there are different reasons for that. Sometimes it goes right back to our childhood. Let me read you just a part of a letter written by a young American college student called Jack to his psychiatrist following his treatment for depression. It's reported in a very fine book by Richard Winter that is called The Roots of Sorrow. He said, only now, as I am coming out of my illness, am I beginning to realize the effect my father's absence during my childhood had on my self-esteem. He gave me everything I needed materially, but by his perpetual absence, what was communicated subliminally was that I really wasn't worth very much. Or else Dad would spend more time with me, wouldn't he? So the drive was triggered inside me to perform, to achieve, to succeed, so as to elicit a positive response from Dad. Then perhaps he'd want to spend time with me. At least that was my subconscious hope. I became obsessed with getting in the football team at school because Dad loved football. I got straight A's in all my subjects, for Dad liked good grades. I applied for medical school so I could become physician, just like Dad. The hunger for self-esteem was so great that I would do anything to satisfy it. And it is that need for approval that drives many workaholics and perfectionists in our world today. No doubt Jack will be busy pursuing his self-esteem in similar ways, and his kids will end up feeling pretty much the same as he did. And so it goes on. Thank you, Steve. Blank slide now, please. Just want to say, if I've touched on something that's hurt for you, do please come and talk to me, or talk to Anita, my wife, or to Sue, or somebody else. But more important than that, will you plug into this series, which goes on week by week for the next 7 or 8 weeks? Because we are looking at something that is vitally relevant to all of that, and is the power of God. Only the power of God can resolve those issues, but that power can, his power can resolve those issues, and many more besides, because it's the power of God, and it's referred to in verse 16. Have a look at it. Where Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone. Verse 17, in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed. Now, if that word salvation seems a bit technical to you, sounds a bit technical, you can translate it as rescue. That's really what it means. Or better still, freedom. Freedom. The gospel is the power of God for freedom to recover our destiny. Mankind is out of control. More on that next week. And we are out of touch with God. But that destiny can be recovered, and we can rediscover God as he gives to us something that is called righteousness. Now, what does that mean? Well, righteousness is a positional word. It means to be in right relationship with someone. So you are in right relationship with your bank manager if your account is in credit. You are in right relationship with your boss if your last appraisal was faultless. And you are in right relationship with God if your moral performance is perfect, which it isn't. And therefore I need a righteousness that comes from God. Just imagine, if you will, that you are a prisoner and you're on death row, and you get a pardon and a release. And that is wonderful. But actually you need more than that, because it's a big bad world out there, and you're not going to make it on your own, even if you have been pardoned and released. But imagine that in addition to pardon, they hang a medal of honor around your neck, telling the world that you are all right, that you are approved, that you are vindicated. That would be different, wouldn't it? That's a rescue. That is salvation. That is true freedom. I don't usually watch much breakfast TV, but you do on holiday, and it's one of the nice things you can do. And we've had this succession of heroes from Rio sitting on the breakfast TV sofas with their gold medals around their necks. And we have honored them for their achievement. And God can honor us. And he can hang the medal around our neck of ultimate victory, ultimate vindication. Can you imagine that? That God can do that for you. How can he do it? Come back, plug into this series, because that's really what's at the heart of this letter to the Romans. This righteousness, this status of being right with God that God confers upon you, this medal that he hangs around your neck. Let me close now with application, if I may, very briefly. And the main application from today's passage is for those of us who would call ourselves committed Christians. And the application is this. Believe your beliefs. If you say you're a Christian, believe this truth. It is true. It's relevant. Can you say the three great I ams of verses 14, 15, and 16? Have a look at them. Verse 14. I am bound. Verse 15. I am eager. Verse 16. I am not ashamed. We are bound. We have an obligation to share this gospel. And we're not reluctant. We are eager to do it. I am eager and I'm not ashamed of it. It may be unpalatable and unpopular, but I am not ashamed of this gospel. And that is going to be one of the keynotes of our whole sermon series. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Second application is to those who can maybe identify with the person referred to on the leaflet. Maybe compulsory RE at school, that may have put you off. Maybe you were confirmed too young, it didn't mean that much to you. You've been agnostic too long, and now I'm confused. And to you, I want to say, doubt your doubts. If Christians need to believe their beliefs, then agnostics need to doubt their doubts, because often as not, they're second-hand. And just as it is unworthy to have a second-hand faith, it's unworthy to have second-hand doubts. So look again. Re-examine them. Re-examine the evidence. You can keep the box, if you like that kind of thing. But make sure that you know the one for whom it is made, Jesus of Nazareth. This series is for everyone. It's for the converted and the confused and anybody in between. Come back next time, Broadwell, 6 p.m. next Sunday evening, and we will find out more. Let's pray.